folks who get us ready for hurricanes get fired. So does a newspaper editor who okayed a controversial Gaza political cartoon. And so does pro-democracy aid in Latin America. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at the Trump administration's layoffs and cutbacks at key science agencies here, some of which involve researchers who've helped revolutionize hurricane forecasting. We'll also talk to the editorial page editor of the Palm Beach Post, who was fired after he ran an editorial cartoon that some Jewish advocates called anti-Semitic. And we'll ask why America, of all countries, is shutting down so much support for democracy struggles in Latin America. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. If you've lived in South Florida as long as I have, you remember when hurricane forecasting was primitive compared to what we have now. Today, we can predict a storm's track and intensity a week in advance, more than twice as early as we could when Hurricane Andrew devastated this community in 1992. Credit for that goes largely to researchers at the Federal National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, or NOAA. It's the sort of life-saving expertise you'd think the government would want to keep around. Instead, the Trump administration late last week began firing that expertise. Almost two dozen scientists were laid off at NOAA's office here on Virginia Key, including many who also helped manage vital fisheries. The Trump firings have reached into our region's wildlife refuges, which protect panthers and nesting sea turtles, and control invasive monsters like pythons. So is this really about enhanced government efficiency, or is it about contempt for science, especially the climate change science NOAA does here? We, of course, want to know what you think. Please call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is WLRN's stellar environment editor, Jenny Stiletovich, who's been watching these firings and their potential impacts. Jenny, how are you?
Good, thank you.
To start here, could you walk us through all the federal environmental agencies and offices that have been hit now by President Trump's so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, headed by billionaire Elon Musk? How many dismissals are we talking about so far?
Well, so I've been keeping track of the layoffs and early retirements here in South Florida. So at the National Park Service, we have a little over 20. At the refuges, there's another 6. And then between Fisheries Science Center on Virginia Key and the AMOL, the Atlantic Oceanographic and Meteorological Lab, which is part of NOAA, is 6. Within the National Park Service layoffs at Everglades National Park, there's a science center that oversees restoration research for the National Park Service. It's played a critical role in Everglades restoration for the last 40 years. They lost 6 people. It's a small office, so losing that was half the staff working
and
on
that,
restoration.
And again, that they are part of trying to get this Everglades restoration kickstarted again, right?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, this team was beefed up. More were added because so much money has been flowing into restoration now. There are a lot of projects in the pipeline, and their mission is to protect the park, the federal lands, the things that we all love, and make sure that these projects deliver the benefits they're supposed to.
And what was the main reason DOGE gave for letting these folks go?
So one of the fired park employees I spoke to said her letter, it was a 4-page letter, said that she was not meeting the demands. It was as like a performance evaluation that she wasn't living up to the expectation, the goals, the missions of the Park Service. Just before, her last job evaluation had been glowing.
Right, and that's been the story throughout federal agencies.
They were just generic letters that went out to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the people who lost their jobs. They obviously didn't do this work to get rich, especially those at the wildlife refuges, for example, but they obviously loved the work, which at the end of the day was important work here when you consider the role the environment plays, not just in South Florida's cultural well-being, but its economic well-being too, right? I mean, from the Everglades to the ocean.
Right, right. So one of the park employees said that they get paid in sunsets. So okay. So when it comes to, for example, the hurricane forecasting stuff, you know, hurricanes are, we live and die by hurricanes in South Florida, literally. And the work that they were doing was building these really complicated forecast models that the National Hurricane Center then depends on to issue their forecasts. Those models have made our forecasting so much better.
And I want to get to know in a second on that. But I first want to talk about how this affects the numerous federal wildlife refuges here. I should point out that next week we're marking Florida Panther Day, for example, and yet the Florida Panther Refuge is one of the places getting hit by these cutbacks. How could this end up hurting wildlife preservation efforts in Florida, especially since it also affects our crackdown on those invasive Burmese pythons that are preying on so much of our vulnerable wildlife down here?
Right. So at that Panther Refuge, they had two biologists, one got fired, and this is a 60,000 acre refuge that also includes the 10,000 islands. Mm-hmm. They do things like monitor trail cams, protect nesting sea turtles. The 10,000 islands is a critical nesting habitat. They go out, build shelters, make sure the nests are undisturbed. They're biologists, but they do everything because the staffs are so small. The Keys National Refuge System, which has four different refuges, only has 10 full-time staff. I mean, they do everything from one of the board members told me that he spent 9 hours with the staff biologist pulling trap line and anchor line off this remote key that can endanger wildlife. So they're doing science and they're doing maintenance.
And given what they earn, the dedication level, as you've pointed out in your reporting, is impressive.
Yes, they barely earn a cost of living. I mean, we're talking $40,000, $60,000. These are not highly paid jobs. The refuges are some of the leanest run public lands in the country. The National Park Service, Biscayne National Park, only has about 36 employees, and they lost 3. And in addition to doing science, maintenance, they do the outreach work. My kids in public school got to go to the national parks, got to go on field trips, overnight camping.
As did mine, yeah.
And it was the Park Service employees that made that possible.
And those things like the sea turtles nesting, that's part of the image of South Florida, no?
Yes.
Yeah, so... Yes. Let's shift over then to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, which has offices here on Virginia Key. What have the DOGE cutbacks done there so far?
So they lost about 16 to 17 jobs in the Fisheries Science Center. These are the guys who collect the data, do the research, do the fish, the population assessments that then get fed into the regulation side, which is handled over in St. Pete Beach. They have a fisheries. Mm-hmm. It's the all of the Southeast fisheries. So we're not just talking about Florida. We are, you know. So that critical science work, they do annual reef assessments for reef fish. It is critical to managing fisheries that are a huge economic driver in South Florida.
Yeah, no. I do want to get to that in a second. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so then I was going to switch over to the hurricane side and the modeling.
And as I mentioned, this would seem to have an even more serious public protection consequence because we're talking about an agency best known for alerting us to and keeping us safe during hurricanes, as you mentioned. So, Jenny, walk us through what NOAA scientists have done over the past decade or so to enhance the hurricane tracking and intensity forecasting that has arguably saved lives and, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of money here and elsewhere in the U.S.
Right. So after those awful 2005 storms, Katrina, Charlie, all these storms, the Hurricane Center said, we're going to start this project in 10 years. We are going to improve our forecast tracks by 50%.
Yeah.
They've done that. I mean, it's remarkable how accurate forecast tracks are.
Yeah.
When it comes to intensity, that has also, I'm sorry, I had to write down some of this stuff because I knew that I would forget like how much it had improved. So with intensity, that has improved 50% as well. With rapid intensification storms, these short fuse storms that give us no time to prepare and can cause the most damage, they can now predict those at about 70% of the time at just a day out. So they're really making leaps and bounds with these next generation forecast models that, you know, a decade ago, I remember when I started covering hurricanes, everything was still like in all caps. When they decided to add commas to right. forecast, that was a thing. Mm-hmm. This is an agency that moves slowly and carefully, and yet on the science side with the advances in computer processing, how quickly these models can digest information now, they've just, it's leaps and bounds. And one of the folks that I talked to who is an expert in atmospheric stuff and hurricane forecasting said that if you stop this progress, like 1 year of progress takes 3 years to make up. So if we stop working on these forecast models, even for a year, we're losing ground.
And you mentioned there are some significant financial impacts of all this as well, right?
Yes. So studies have shown that since these improvements have come around with major hurricanes, mm-hmm. per hurricane since I think it was about 2002 or 2005, we're saving $5 billion per hurricane in property and loss of life.
Yeah.
Weaker storms, it's only about $2 billion, only $2 billion, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the cost involved, the savings, in life and property, I mean.
So this is about our pocketbooks as well. So given all that, I want to listen here to what former NOAA Administrator Rick Spinrad said last Friday about how these cuts will affect the agency's mission.
The progress, any of the progress that has been made over the last several years, including in reducing the errors in the track forecast of hurricanes, reducing the errors in the intensity forecast, I think it's safe to say that that will be compromised.
So that was former NOAA Administrator Rick Spinrad. We have Pete on the line from Miami. Pete, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What's your perspective on all of this?
Well, big fan of the show. I appreciate you guys covering these topics like this.
Well, thanks.
It's like the voters continuously ask the state to help do more to help with our environment, whether it's restoring the natural flow of the rivers. And I'm glad you guys tied in all the fisheries and things. They help with tourism. They help keep our hotels full, right?
Right.
Everybody wants to come down here for that. And if the oceans are polluted with phosphates being dumped in the water, nobody's checking on these things.
Yeah.
People have to realize that's a sad part of what's happening.
Right. No. Pete, that's a great point. The environment is the economy in so many ways here in South Florida.
Even like, okay, just say you don't want to fish or anything. You're just a boater.
Yeah.
Do you want to go out on your boat on a nasty intercoastal waterway that's polluted because people aren't keeping up with it?
Mm-hmm.
And or do you want to go to a state park that's not being maintained or taken care of? Because it's sad that we're voting against our own self-interest sometimes.
Well,
and I wonder where the state is in coming in and filling these gaps.
Well,
and who's going to fill these gaps?
That's a topic for another show. But Pete,
and
thanks. Pete, I've got to move on. But thanks very much for your call. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Jenny Stiletovich about the firings at environmental and meteorological federal agencies whose work, like hurricane forecasting, impacts this community's well-being. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Jenny, I want to go back to what Rick Spinrad just said earlier in that tape and ask you from your own perspective as an especially trusted environmental journalist here, how these DOGE cuts stand to impact services like the earlier and more reliable hurricane tracking and intensity forecasting we've come to expect now in storm-prone regions like ours.
Well, I think the big concern I have is we've seen that storms are growing more intense. The rapid intensification storms are happening more frequently. The science needs to keep up with that. If we're not able to continue to forecast these storms that are coming, you know, quicker, faster, more intense.
And with a lot more surge, for example.
Right, yeah. Right. I mean, this is the emergency managers depend on these forecasts to tell you when to leave your home. They also when not to leave your home.
Mm-hmm.
The savings that we get because people don't have to evacuate are often
right. So
you know,
that we're not creating these huge traffic jams on I-75 when it's really not necessary.
Right. Yep. We don't want to go through Irma again.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Any other effects that you fear could be coming down the pipe?
I mean, just the park system. Like I said, they're already understaffed, and you know, going to a park, we get to enjoy clean bathrooms. You know, when you're
again to what Pete was saying, you know,
right, and enforcement. We didn't even talk about the planned lease terminations for federal offices. One of the offices that was listed was the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Office in Doral, where it's a hub for law enforcement.
Yeah.
So,
as you began to mention earlier, this isn't just about hurricanes. We're also talking about a potentially big impact on our ocean waters here, and especially our vital fisheries, right? Not to mention how these federal government scientists aid navigation for all our all-important commercial maritime shipping or our satellite operations. Take us through a little bit of those effects, too, which are important.
Well, so people may not realize that NOAA also forecasts space weather.
Right.
And so if NOAA is not forecasting space weather, we're surrounded by satellites we depend on for our navigation and GPS. So if they're not issuing really up-to-date space weather forecasts, then satellite operators are not going to be as efficient.
And that's a part of NOAA that I think most people, including myself, were clueless about.
Right, yeah. Right.
So let's step back a minute, Jenny, and talk about the larger and more political picture at play here, something more ideological than financial. Is it accurate to suggest that a lot of what's going on here isn't just about federal government belt tightening, but also, let's say, a more cultural clash between President Trump's MAGA movement and the science movement? Is it reasonable to suggest, for example, that the Trump administration objects to the climate change and global warming science NOAA does?
Right. No, I think that they have made that clear, that the science behind climate change, they're not into it.
Yeah.
You know, and that you know, we science provides data and facts. It's supposed to give you the view of this is reality, and sometimes that runs into politics. Mm-hmm. And so I think this administration does not want to be hampered all the time by the data and the science that can contradict some of their policies.
Why then, though, would that apply to helping panthers and sea turtles, do you think?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if it's a fact of, like, nature doesn't need to have help. I think a lot of the Doge cuts were it was a sledgehammer. Somebody said that to me. I mean, they weren't going through with a scalpel. It was just like, oh, this has this word in it, and we're going
to... Well, that brings me to my last question for you. What's your guess as to whether these firings and other cuts even hold up? I mean, there's been a lot of speculation that what Doge is doing is illegal. Do you see this all going to court?
Well, it has already. In San Francisco, a judge issued an order saying these mass firings were not legal. So we'll see what happens. There are, you know, the National Park Rangers Association is keeping track of this. There are other legal organizations, I think, that are watching for openings to make a legal maneuver.
We'll stay tuned. Jenny Stiletovich is WLRN's environment editor. Jenny, thanks as always.
Thanks, Tim.
Still to come, was a political cartoon that got a Palm Beach Post editor fired really anti-Semitic or just anti-Netanyahu? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Ever since the terrorist group Hamas sparked the ongoing Gaza war back on October 7th, 2023, when it heinously massacred 1,200 Israeli civilians and took 250 more as hostages, and ever since the Israeli military mounted a counterattack that most of the world has condemned as excessively brutal in light of the estimated 40,000 Palestinians killed in the conflict, one of the big points of debate here has been, if you criticize Israel's military actions, does that somehow make you anti-Semitic too? That question is now hanging over the Palm Beach Post, where last month its owner, the Gannett Company, fired editorial page editor Tony Doris because he approved a political cartoon that did criticize Israel. It didn't go after Jews or the Jewish faith per se. Its focus was the government of Israel. But many Jewish community leaders in Palm Beach County called it anti-Semitic anyway. Doris, who is Jewish himself, and the cartoonist, whose father is Jewish, insist it was anti-war, not anti-Semitic. Either way, this is a particularly important South Florida discussion, and we'd like to know your thoughts, as long as those thoughts are not anti-Semitic or, for that matter, Islamophobic. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is the former Palm Beach Post editorial page editor, Tony Doris. Tony, thank you very much for coming in.
It's an honor to be here, Tim, and to be on WLRN, my favorite radio station.
Thank you very much. Let's first familiarize our listeners who may not have seen this editorial cartoon, what it depicts and what it says. Can you describe it for us, and who is the political cartoonist who drew it?
The cartoonist is a former Washington Post cartoonist who's with a separate syndicate now. Mm-hmm. His name is Jeff Danziger. He is a an 80-something-year-old former Vietnam veteran who thinks he knows a thing or two about the horrors of war.
Yeah.
And he says that's all he was describing. And that's how I interpreted the cartoon. I didn't even see it as anti-Netanyahu. You could, I guess, look at it and feel that it was critical of the Israeli government. Mm-hmm. But in any event, you know, my position is obvious.
Can you describe it for us?
Yes, I'm sorry.
No.
It shows two Israeli soldiers carrying to safety a released hostage walking across or past the bodies of dead Palestinians. And there is a sign that says 40,000 Palestinians killed.
And a caption, one of the Israeli soldiers is saying, watch your step.
Watch your step.
Right.
Yeah.
Obviously then it's sending a strong, visceral message about the Gaza conflict. Why in the end did you feel it was an important message to include on the Palm Beach Post editorial page then? And just as important, Tony, why did you feel it was not an anti-Semitic message, particularly considering, as I mentioned earlier, that you yourself are Jewish and the father of Jeff Danziger, the cartoonist, was Jewish?
Yeah, I felt it was a very effective lamentation of war and of the violence and hatred and of hostage-taking, kidnapping. It did not excuse the barbarian acts of Hamas that set off the whole thing. I felt that it was not at all anti-Semitic because there was nothing, just because you're not happy with or are uncomfortable with the policies of the Israeli government doesn't mean that you're anti-Jewish. Mm-hmm. And those two things should not be conflated. And I think, frankly, that the Jewish Federation of Palm Beach County is going to find out that many, if not most, Jews feel the way I do, and that you can't shut down the conversation just because you're not comfortable with it. In fact, it's healthier to have the conversation.
Okay, well, let's talk about the Palm Beach County's, the Jewish Federation of Palm Beach County. I did speak this week with Michael Hoffman, the president and CEO of the Jewish Federation of Palm Beach County, which led the protest against the cartoon, which then led Gannett to fire you. When I asked Mr. Hoffman to explain why he insisted this anti-war cartoon was also anti-Semitic, he told me that because we've seen a spike in anti-Semitic incidents in Palm Beach County since the Gaza war started, quote, we can no longer dissociate anti-Israel sentiments with anti-Jewish sentiments. Mr. Hoffman also said he believed the cartoon, quote, drastically trivialized the plight of the Israeli hostages. So, Tony, I want to unpack that first assertion Michael Hoffman makes, that any criticism of Israel's admittedly controversial conduct in the Gaza conflict is also anti-Semitic, an attack on Jews and Judaism. As a Gentile journalist who has always gone out of my way to condemn anti-Semitism, but who has also condemned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's conduct, I have to admit I have a hard time accepting Mr. Hoffman's argument that the latter somehow makes me guilty of the former. But as both a journalist and a Jewish person, Tony, how do you respond to his assertion?
I think Mr. Hoffman has just called half of Israel anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. Because there are plenty in Israel who also oppose the policies of his hard right coalition. And again, I would say that this cartoon is not necessarily anti-Netanyahu. It laments the horrors of war.
Okay. What about Mr. Hoffman's other assertion there that the cartoon, quote, trivialized the plight of the Israeli hostages, the way it depicts the soldiers stepping over dead Palestinians? He felt that that was, as he said, a trivialization.
It's a dramatic statement, but it doesn't trivialize anything. I mean, you know, I'm a huge supporter of the state of Israel, so proud of it, so proud of my heritage. I don't see how that in any way trivializes the horrors that were brought on Israel by Hamas. Mm-hmm. It does make a statement about how horrible, like as I said, the violence is in war. And I think it's important to have that conversation. And if there is, if it is seen as critical of Israel, let's discuss that. I don't think you solve issues by shutting them down.
Mm-hmm. Along those lines, is it reasonable to suggest that the cartoon was also trying to point out that while the media here have justifiably cast a great deal of attention on the Israeli hostages, we have perhaps not given enough attention to the just as tragic deaths of innocent Palestinians? Is that perhaps an undercurrent that the cartoon was maybe trying to convey as well?
Maybe, but I can only tell you what I thought it was, and that was, as I've said, a lamentation of the violence of war. And the cartoonist himself, speaking in the New York Times and in local mm-hmm. publications, did not say anything other than that. He said, mm-hmm. you know, hey, I've been to Vietnam, spent a lot of time there. I think I know what death and violence are and how bad it is, and that's what I was trying to show.
It's interesting you mentioned Vietnam, because when I was a young reporter in Chicago, I was a very good friend of the cartoonist there. And in 1988, when Dan Quayle was nominated as vice president, there was a lot of controversy about how he got out of the Vietnam War by going off to play golf with the National Guard. And the cartoonist drew a cartoon of Dan Quayle playing golf while we're watching napalmed kids in Vietnam run, you know, in that classic image from the war. And he has Quayle saying, "Mind if I play through?" Now, that was also a very controversial and visceral statement about Dan Quayle and the Vietnam War, but I don't remember, you know, that cartoonist being fired.
It's in the best traditions of cartooning, you know, to emphasize and accent things that maybe we're uncomfortable with, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it tracks one-on-one with the way things are, but I think you could argue in this case that the actual reality on the ground probably a lot more harsh than what was depicted in that cartoon.
Yeah. And is it also apt to ask, what if the scenario had been reversed? What if Mr. Dangeter had given you a cartoon that showed UN workers carrying dead Palestinian children across Gaza with perhaps dead Israeli hostages that they're having to step over, making the same comment? Do you think there had been as much outcry if the scenario of the cartoon had been reversed that way?
Yeah, you'd need to ask Mr. Hoffman there. That question. But I also think, you know, you see them complaining about the number 40,000 dead. And I would say, again, another interpretation. If it was 20,000 dead, would you be okay with that? If it was 5,000? Yep. Come on. It's human lives.
Yep. We have Barbara on the line from Hollywood. Barbara, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What's your perspective on this?
Thank you. Well, I'm Jewish, and I'm against what Israel is doing in Gaza because it's a question of humanity, not religion or ethnicity. And regarding, you know, criticism, if we can't be honest, we're lost.
Well, thanks very much, Barbara. I appreciate your perspectives there. Now, for its part, Tony, the Palm Beach Post parent company, Gannett, said in a statement that it fired you because the editorial cartoon, quote, did not meet our standards and would not have been published if the proper protocols were followed. What standards and what protocols are they referring to exactly?
You know, I hate to be sarcastic, but maybe their standards are to not offend people or not upset people. But an editorial page and an editorial cartoon is meant to raise conversations and to provoke people into thinking.
But were you given any reasons more specific than what that statement?
No, they told me something to the effect that I couldn't be counted on to uphold the guidelines and standards of Gannett. Of course, no one ever tells you what the guidelines and standards are, and I can tell you I worked there as an investigative reporter, city hall reporter, government editor and opinion editor for 21 years, and no one ever questioned my editorial judgment. My name was on the masthead. They seemed to be okay until they came up with some cross currents from the Jewish Federation.
Right. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with former Palm Beach Post editorial page editor Tony Doris, who was recently fired for running a political cartoon critical of the Israeli military's conduct in the Gaza War. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Tony, picking up on what we were just discussing about the somewhat murky reasons Gannett gave you for your firing, do you feel they themselves have stepped into a First Amendment minefield, perhaps, here, not just because they dismissed you over this cartoon, but because they've essentially said themselves, we consider this cartoon's anti-war statement to be an anti-Semitic statement? And that potentially takes us into free speech territory, does it not?
It does, but I think what it amounts to is that Gannett is just uncomfortable with controversy. I mean, it's the state of newspapers today. I mean, just like the Washington Post and the LA Times, Gannett banned us from editorial pages from endorsing a presidential candidate. Mm-hmm. No reason given except obviously, you know, they don't want to reduce their number of page views by upsetting part of the audience. And so they pull their punches. Mm-hmm. And again, in this case, was it First Amendment or was it just that, you know, for business reasons, you know, they don't want to upset people.
But there's also the current political ambiance that's at play here as well. The Trump administration, obviously, much more supportive of Israel in this conflict than the Palestinian side. But that would seem to bring us more specifically to the efforts critics say we're seeing the Trump administration and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis undertake recently to clamp down on protests against Israel, not Judaism, but Israel, especially on college campuses, by equating, let's say, anti-Netanyahuism with anti-Semitism. I'll be the first to condemn a college freshman who supports Hamas's atrocities. But again, does this sort of thing flirt with First Amendment violations?
If you pull your punches on presidential endorsements, and then you pull your punches on what you're allowed to say about Israel, what are you going to pull your punches on next? What is the mission in journalism of an editorial page? To raise conversations, to point out points of view, to discuss the issues and bring up public awareness. If you're not going to do that, then what is it there for at all? And it's just the mission of journalism. And, you know, newspapers are embattled these days, especially big corporations that have debt to pay off, and they're trying to change the trends in journalism and get more people reading. And sometimes they pull their punches, and that's what this is all about. Instead, I think they ought to double down on their mission.
Mm-hmm. Even more specifically, Tony, how important is it that we start discussing this more honestly, especially here in South Florida? We obviously have a large Jewish population here, and to Mr. Hoffman's point, we have seen a distressing rise in anti-Semitic incidents here since the Gaza War started. But we also have a large Muslim population in South Florida, and we've also seen a distressing rise in Islamophobic incidents here since the conflict began. And I'll admit, I get just as impatient when someone accuses me of being anti-Palestinian or anti-Muslim when I justifiably condemn Hamas as a terrorist organization. So how do we start changing how we discuss this issue here, Tony?
Well, the first point is, do these problems disappear when you refuse to talk about them? I don't think so. I think you need to address them head on, not try to stop someone whose opinion you're uncomfortable with from speaking at all. And that goes for any kind of discrimination. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that the Palm Beach Post has run, you know, many editorials and op-ed pieces from very different perspectives and sharing a diversity of views. And that's what's needed, you know, having the conversation, talking it out. I don't think they get to tell me that I can't talk about it and I can't discuss it.
And did you raise these issues with the Gannett people when they came to you and said they were letting you go because of this?
They didn't want to hear it. No, they just wanted to know why they didn't know about it in advance. Why didn't more people see this cartoon before it went in the paper?
Right. Tony Doris is the former editorial page editor of the Palm Beach Post. Tony, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Tim. Thank you so much.
Still to come, why is the U.S. canceling pro-democracy aid in repressive anti-democracy strongholds like Cuba. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. First, it was USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, that felt President Trump's draconian cuts to foreign aid, including pro-democracy efforts like those that helped Venezuela's opposition prove that dictator Nicolas Maduro lost last summer's presidential election by a landslide. Then there was the National Endowment for Democracy, which this week sued the Trump administration and Miami's own Secretary of State Marco Rubio for blocking its funding for pro-democracy initiatives. Now we've learned that Trump has canceled aid for a raft of pro-democracy programs run by none other than the nonprofit International Republican Institute, which is linked to the president's own party and which supports activism in some of Latin America's most anti-democratic places, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. So how's that going down with Cubans, Venezuelans, and Nicaraguans here, who largely support Trump and Rubio? Let us know what you think. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Miami Cuban exile Gennady Rodriguez, host of the popular YouTube podcast 23 y Flagler, which has been watching this closely. Gennady, always great to have you on.
Thank you, team, and you know, good morning to all the audience.
As a Cuban exile, Gennady, what has been your reaction to these cancellations of funding for pro-democracy efforts back in your home country, Cuba?
Tim, to be honest, I have been trying to Trump not to surprise me. So I have been letting my imagination go a little bit wild. Okay. But this did surprise me, to be honest. Uh-huh. And yeah, actually, most of the people who have been working, at least from the Cuban community, in these pro-democracy programs have been very pro-Republican Party and pro-Trump. And what I'm seeing right now is that after this announcement that actually came from Rubio, with no better excuse than it's not on the national interest, or, for example, in the account of the Rapid Response 47 of the White House, saying some of these projects were ridiculous. I mean, ridiculous was the word they used.
Yes, no, and I want to get into that, yeah, later. But how do you, as a Cuban exile, I mean, look, I've been following your activities and your efforts in this arena, this pro-democracy arena in Cuba for more than a decade now, if not almost two decades. So I know how passionate you are about this, for example, but so how did this strike you personally as a Cuban exile?
Well, I would say that not even Obama dared to this. Not even Obama, the man who went there and spoke to Raul Castro.
Right, meaning former President Barack Obama, who normalized relations with communist Cuba in 2014.
Exactly, because I think from my part, I always said that an approachment and engagement with Cuba is good. But I never said that stop talking about democracy in Cuba is a good thing. Yeah. It's not. And stop helping, you know, political prisoners or activists. That's not a good thing in any way.
Right. And I should say this is probably a fairly ironic situation for you, because you and your podcast, 23 y Flagler, are often criticized by more conservative and hardline Cuban exiles because, as you said, you do support U.S. engagement with Cuba, and therefore they accuse you of somehow being a foe of democracy in Cuba, and now we're watching a U.S. president they support pull back funding to promote democracy in Cuba. Does any of this make any sense to you?
It's very ironic, Tim, to be honest. You know, I have been always the communist for these guys just because I said that regime change was maybe not the best strategy with Cuba, but I never said stop talking about democracy or stop helping activists was a good strategy. I absolutely never said that. And now it's them who are justifying Trump and blaming the activists, or I'm sure there is someone blaming the political prisoners as well for this decision. Instead, they should be blaming Marco Rubio and Donald Trump for whatever decision process they made.
Right. Well, before we get into that decision process, Gennady, take us and our listeners through some of the projects and organizations inside Cuba that the nonprofit International Republican Institute was supporting, the programs that maybe stand out to you the most that are now going to lose their funding.
Well, we have the media ecosystem. That's the one I'm more familiar with because, you know, I'm in the media business right. and the environment. And I know for sure that many independent journalists in Cuba are now not going to be able to publish what they're doing. And they're going to go into a much more vulnerable position because now all you have is visibility to protect from abuses in authoritarian countries such as Cuba. Mm-hmm. But there are also projects that helps people who are being harassed by the government to understand what little of rights they have within Cuba. And now not even that. I mean, I'm talking about attorneys
yeah.
or who are familiar with the judicial system in Cuba that can provide some advice to these people. That's gone as well. So it's like you leave all the people who are fighting in Cuba by themselves. And look, I have been very critic about the United States funding these projects. I'm not saying that there should be some criticism, and there is some legit criticism to this.
Right.
But doing from one day to the other, without the transition, without asking for Cuban and the civil society to find different funding, you know, sources,
yeah.
or to be able to have any kind of logical transition to this is what I think it's really hurt. It's going to hurt a lot of people and it's going to cause a lot of pain.
And political prisoners are also going to be affected by this. Help us understand how, I mean, which is important because we've got more than 1,000 political prisoners by estimates inside Cuba today. How will their plight be affected by this cut in funding?
Well, initially, as I mentioned, like attorneys, people who are independent attorneys, they don't work for the state.
Right.
They belong to organizations such as Cubalex, for example, that they can get some legal advice mm-hmm. out of people who are not linked anyhow, who operate, you know, basically outside of the Cuban government.
Right.
And they can also, the problem with all of this is also visibility. If there are not enough media who are showing if there is any kind of abuse with your case, or if, you know, if you have been beaten, I don't know, in a jail, or if you have been arrested mm-hmm. in a very regular way, well, generally, this kind of media is the one who's going to go out there and say, people, look, this is what happens.
Right.
And at least it's some kind of protection. But now, mm-hmm. Who's going to ring the bell.
What about in other Latin American countries, Gennady, especially Venezuela and Nicaragua, which are also ruled by repressive left-wing dictatorships? Let's talk about the sort of pro-democracy efforts these cuts affect in those countries as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, in Venezuela, it's very similar. The people who were able to get all the documentation from the last election that showed that Edmundo González was actually the winner, those people were funded by USAID. And yeah. now, there's no funding for that. Why? I mean, Biden, even though I did not agree with everything Biden did, he did indeed isolate Maduro from the rest of the world and for the first time showed the entire world that, hey, man, what's happening in Venezuela
right.
is not right. Look the results, look the activists. I mean, even Chile, who has a left-wing, you know, president, was distancing themselves from Maduro until Donald Trump sent Grenell.
Right. And in Nicaragua, we've got the Catholic Church, which is probably one of the last bulwarks against Nicaraguan dictator Daniel Ortega. It was depending on some of this funding as well, no?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
Gennady, what are the reasons the Trump administration has been giving for eliminating this funding? The answer we usually hear is the, quote, it doesn't align with U.S. interests, as you pointed out. And the administration is calling a $1.5 million grant to promote independent, pro-democratic media in Cuba as, quote, ridiculous, as you also earlier pointed out. But again, when did building a free press in Cuba become ridiculous?
That's a good question. I have no idea. And, you know, but look, I have been saying this could happen for months now, even from the campaign. When Trump said, hey, if I don't win the elections, I'm going to exile to Venezuela, that should have been a very red flag mm-hmm. because he was legitimizing Maduro from that very point.
Okay.
And from there to now, it's not a long run. I mean, if there's some backlash, maybe Trump goes... It takes a little step back, but we now know what's in his heart. I think he definitely believed that he should not be pursuing democracy or regime change anywhere, but he should not be even supporting people who wants to speak on behalf of democracy.
But he's also claiming that, no, this is just about more government efficiency. This is about saving the federal government money because we're pouring too much money into these efforts. But who knows? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Cuban exile Gennady Rodriguez, host of the 23 Flagler podcast, about the Trump administration's controversial shutdown of pro-democracy aid in Latin America. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. I want to pivot here, Gennady, to one of the central figures in this whole controversy, who's especially central to us here because he's a Cuban-American from Miami, and that's former Florida Senator and now President Trump's Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. He's the first person mentioned, for example, in the National Endowment for Democracy's lawsuit against the Trump administration and its funding cuts. But Rubio is a man who has spent his entire political career applauding and advocating for pro-democracy programs like the ones being terminated. In fact, he's a former International Republican Institute board member. How do we explain his about-face?
It's unexplainable, you know. And yeah, of course. I mean, we can say he completely gave up his principles and he's just doing Trump's dirty work.
But again, in his defense, his argument is he's just following the new policy that these funding these programs is not, quote, in the interest of U.S. foreign policy. So I just want to put his argument out there, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nice way to put it. But the truth is that the same people who push him to power, his very own base here, the Cuban American exiles, have been betrayed. And they have been betrayed because they understand how important these projects are. And look, it takes years to create the kind of logistics and the kind of relationship that you need to have these operations in place. And now he's just coming back and saying, look, well, we don't want to do this anymore. It's not in the national interest. Hey, man, but everybody here was trusting that now with Marco Rubio in the State Department, everything was going to be like the most beautiful
right
path to democracy in Cuba. But actually,
when and not just in Cuba, but all over Latin America.
Yeah, exactly. I'm saying particularly in Cuba because he identifies
as Cuban. Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you want to understand how personal this should be for him. And to be honest, I think this is part of Trump's strategy. I don't think Trump wants Marco Rubio as a political figure anymore. That's my personal opinion. And making him coming to this community and gutting the exact same people, the exact same projects that really propel him to power, I think everyone's going to look at Marco Rubio and going to say, wow, this guy's a traitor.
Right. Well, Gennady, in just the minute we have left, what have people been saying on your YouTube podcast, 23 Flagler, about this? Are they angry? Do they agree with what Trump is doing? What's been the reaction? Just about 30 seconds, please.
I think it's the grief stages. They're first in denial, then they're going to be enraged, and then they're going to negotiate. But right now, they're blaming everybody except Marco Rubio and Trump, who actually were the ones making the decision.
Okay. Gennady Rodriguez hosts the YouTube podcast 23 Flagler. Gennady, thanks as always. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Dean.
Finally on the roundup, we want to pay tribute to two South Florida giants who died this past week, former Miami Congressman Lincoln Diaz-Balart and Miccosukee tribe leader Billy Cypress. Diaz-Balart was an architect of the remarkable political and economic power the Cuban exile community built in Miami and in Washington. He and his younger brother, Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart, were born in Cuba into a high-profile political family with ties to the late communist dictator Fidel Castro, who at one time was married to the Diaz-Balart's aunt. Lincoln Diaz-Balart, a Republican, became one of Castro's fiercest foes, and he was also known for championing migrants and refugees of any nationality. Lincoln Diaz-Balart died Monday. He was 70. Billy Cypress was likewise an architect of the remarkable clout the Miccosukee tribe of Indians of Florida have built. He parlayed their prodigious casino revenues into legal action to preserve and restore the Everglades. Cyprus was the longest-serving Miccosukee chairman, and he took on everyone from Congress to Big Sugar to protect his tribe's home. He was also fun to talk to. He once told me, "We're Indians, Tim, but our casino money allows us to be like the cowboys. We can bring in the hired guns." Billy Cyprus died last Friday. He was 74. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answered the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.